Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast with Bhairav Patel and Alan Clark.
Welcome to the Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast, where we tackle the practical challenges that startup founders and small business owners face and give our own unvarnished opinions. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm the Managing Director at Atom Ventures and Atom CTO, where we partner with small businesses and startup founders to help them define and build their tech vision.
And I'm Alan Clark. I'm the founder of the Business Growth Partnership, and we work with high potential businesses to help them unblock the blockages that are preventing them from reaching their full potential. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of the Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast. Today, we're going to have a chat about entering new markets. But before we do that, Bhairav, what have you been up to this week?
I've had a very, very interesting week. So it's been, in a weird way, it's been less busy, but more things have happened. I don't know if that makes any sense.
So
I did a presentation to a group of startups in Philadelphia. So for an incubator that we worked with, 1776, about aligning your business and tech strategy. It was one of those presentations where I thought I would only talk about 15 minutes, but actually it was like 45 minutes later, I'm still going through it. And it's interesting because I think the one question I got asked, which was a good question, was that should you buy or build, or do something else? And as always, the answer to these things, it depends. But as I said to those guys, whenever you're looking at building technology, look and see if you can buy it first and then optimize later. Because you should always customize the things that are special to you, like special to your business, and then try and build as little as possible to begin with, because you don't know how your business is going to go, right? You don't know how the processes will work. You don't know what the customers will react to, et cetera. So that was interesting. But perhaps the most crazy thing was, this new company that we're launching called DeFacto, which eventually will subsume everything else that we do. And so that's a blockchain business where in one sentence, we are trying to bridge the gap between traditional finance and decentralized finance. So you probably don't know much about the decentralized finance world, but there's billions and billions of dollars sitting in liquidity pools on the blockchain. And if you can see all the hype that goes on at the moment, it's around NFTs, these non-fungible tokens. And I don't know if you've seen the news about Jiffy being sold for $65 million and people putting art and the club sandwich on the blockchain and all these kinds of things,
yeah.
Right? And so that can only really last for so long. And there's only so many people that can pay X millions for artwork. And there's only so much you can do with cryptocurrency, and trying to arbitrage off the pricing of both, of different coins. So what the community is crying out for is real world assets. So things like invoice financing, property deals, loans, whatever it is, bonds. And, our platform is seeking to enable people who have real world assets and get them funding through the liquidity pools on the blockchain. So what we're actually doing is providing that bridge, the glue, the technical bridge, because the problem is that if you're trying to do this for yourself, you have to have a tech team. There's a lot of work to be done, due diligence. You have to learn a lot. There's a big technical barrier to entry. And we're trying to lower that technical barrier to entry, which is the main goal of that project and democratize financing. So as part of that long-winded answer, we have to do obviously a token sale. And that is selling tokens that we will be minting in order for the platform to work. And as part of that, you have to do marketing. So we did an Ask Me Anything on Telegram. First time I've done this in the crypto sphere. And you had 14,000 people in a chat, which is not a lot really, apparently.
What?
And 14,000 people on the chat. And then we were answering questions that were put on Twitter beforehand, actually. And then it opened up for 100 seconds to the audience that was there. And within that 100 seconds, we got 4,500 questions come in. We had to pick five and answer those five. So as you can imagine, it was very crazy. So it was fun. It was very, very good. Interesting communities and great support out there. But it's a new world. And
I feel there's an entire series of podcasts in which I say, so Bhairav, please explain blockchain to me.
Well, funnily enough, I do have another podcast on what is blockchain, but I think we should do that. I think what we should do is bring in someone who's been working. So one of the partners that we've got, they've been working with the blockchain for many, many years now, because they can talk a little bit more about the evolution, which I think is very interesting. So
your exciting week has been about blockchain. My probably most exciting news this week is about plant pots.
Planting in pots or just plant pots themselves?
Making plant pots.
Oh, wow.
And it's a chap that I've got to know recently. I'm doing some work with, who is a deep sea diver and got sick to death of the amount of plastic floating about in the ocean. And about 9 months ago, decided that he was going to make plant pots out of that plastic waste.
Wow.
And at the turn of the year, made his first plant pot out of recycled, what do you call it, ghost fishing gear, I think they call it. I think that's the term for it. And during the week there, his product won both Best Sustainable Product at the Chelsea Flower Show from Nowhere. And he also won at the Scottish Edge Awards.
Wow.
To give him a big injection of a financial prize and a loan into his business. And you know what? He is one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. And his entire business started with, I'm sick to death of what we're doing to our planet. And I see it when I'm out underwater every day. I see the reality. So here we are, a little bit down the line, he's selling tens of thousands of pounds worth of plant pots every month. And it's all going forward. And you know what? Huge inspiration. Hugely motivating to be around people like that. So anyway, enough of all that stuff. Today we're going to talk about entering new territories. I'm going to throw this straight over to you, Barab, because while I was involved in working in many territories, I didn't really go down the route of opening them up. Although one of the companies I'm working with now is seeking international doors, but you've done a lot more of this. Tell me a little bit about your background in opening up new markets abroad internationally.
So I guess it probably started, it did start with the online cosmetic store that I was a CTO of in Norway. So there was, it's called, in Norwegian it's called Blivaka, which means be beautiful, but they are, the owner and I came up with the name Coco Panda, which you can see it's still operating now and has increased into other markets. And we launched or relaunched that online e-commerce website, I think back in 2009-10. And by 2011-12, what we were looking at was launching into new markets. So we were obviously in the Norwegian market, but we weren't in any other market. And so we went to Denmark, actually. So the first market was Denmark. We opened up an e-commerce store in Denmark, which Sweden quickly followed, and had the logistics in Germany. So we had the warehousing in Germany. So we didn't obviously want to send goods directly from Norway because even though it's EU, and as everyone knows, the EU is not actually a homogenous place, there was obviously lots of import-export laws going on, even internally. Those are the issues that you had to deal with back in those days. And then when it came to Aztec, which is a fintech, we were doing global supply chain finance. We launched from day one, we were operating in 38 different countries. And then obviously that, so the legal framework and the software worked in 38 different countries. And obviously then we had to kind of grow into those territories and actually start trying to operate on the ground. And we did have successful operations, obviously in Spain, Italy, Chile, Mexico, US, Canada, Ireland, Singapore and South Africa. So we did that globally. And then with a couple of other companies that I've been on the board of, we've been taking them out to places like Kenya, Uganda, trying to launch versions of their platform out there. So one was an app that is used by universities and to basically communicate with their students. And so what was interesting there was we were trying to get the university in Nairobi involved with that. And that was a very long and drawn out process, quite complicated. And then obviously now with, when I was in Bangkok working in an e-commerce business there, we were in Thailand and China, but then launched out in Malaysia. So I was working a little bit out there with that. And then after I left, it was in Vietnam, and obviously these guys were selling globally. And then with Atom now, what we're doing at the moment is trying to get out into the US market. So we've obviously are in the UK market, and I've been spending the last five months trying to push out into the US market with what we do at Atom CTO.
We would normally, if we read up how to grow your business internationally, we could always use your stuff about having a very strong strategic imperative for why you need to do this, and then going through an exercise and identifying the risks that are involved in making that move, and the technology that's required, and looking at legal, as you mentioned there, about import and export regulations, etc., and conformity, and then also developing a very tight resource plan so that you truly understand what's involved. That was, of course, how you approached all of the territorial moves.
Yeah, that would be great if we did. I remember when we were, at least in Norway, when we were looking at figuring out where to go, it was like, where should we go next? Well, Denmark. We know this guy who can help us in Denmark. Let's go to Denmark. And then you just learn by doing, right? Obviously, Scandinavia is a little bit different. It's fairly homogenous. It's not, you know, between Sweden, Denmark, and Norway, things aren't wildly different. What was interesting was Aztec. I think the mistake that we made there was trying to go into too many different countries at the same time. Not necessarily because that's, it's not necessarily a bad thing. We had a lot of money. We had $12 million in the bank. So it wasn't that it was a cost issue. But I think it was a bit gung-ho. Everyone just kind of went out there assuming, well, everyone needs money. It's got to be easy, right? But what you forget is that each country is very culturally different, and the way that they'll react to what you're trying to do is very different. And the way to do business is, again, very different. And even though we had people from those countries working there on the ground, talking to suppliers, when you're trying at the very top level to push results and you're wondering why things go slowly, it's because you haven't really understood the kind of market you're trying to get yourself into.
So does that really endorse then that obviously I was being teasing you with my approach, or not my approach, the textbook approach to doing it in comparison with the reality of how you did it? And certainly there's one company I'm working with now that has moved into, well, I think it sells to about 50 or 60 countries through a direct-to-consumer model, but a lot of them are by accident. People have found them, placed an order, yeah. We'll post it from Glasgow out to you. But there's maybe 10 or 12 of them actually made an effort to focus and do a bit of development. But what they are recognising now is this was all opportunistic. None of it was strategic. And now with the benefit of hindsight, actually we would never have done what we did had we thought about the implications. Is this really now what we're looking at? Is actually all of those great articles, all of that great advice about a strategic imperative, about having done a good risk-reward planning, having investigated the regulatory requirements and checking, all of that stuff. Is that what you would do now? Is that what you would recommend people listening to do?
So I think that what's really interesting here, there's a number of different approaches, right? And the way that we've approached, I think what you can see now is the maturity of the approach that we've taken with Atom, as opposed to some of the other approaches. The approach we're taking now has worked. So let's talk through a few of these approaches that we had, right? So we had, obviously you and I met through Avrium. And so we had an approach that, and that, even though that wasn't global, we were looking, trying to get around the country. And I think there's a template there. Then there was this company in Thailand that I worked with, and then obviously Aztec and Atom at the moment, right? So let's start with the company in Thailand, Chilindo. So my friend was the CEO there, and his it was quite funny, actually. It's funny and annoying and scary and just crazy at the same time, because his attitude was, I remember him saying this to me, he goes, right, we're going to go into Vietnam, but I'm not telling anyone in the business we're launching in Vietnam. He just went and got the office space, found the warehousing, started hiring the secretary, started doing some of the sales without telling the rest of the business, and then came back and said, right, we are now in Vietnam. I want you to get this done in 2 months, right? We have to have the full supply chain, all the products need to be sold, the website needs to be changed, everything like that, which was just huge pressure. Now, as an entrepreneur, when he started off that business and he did that for Thailand, Malaysia, China, it worked. It worked like a charm, right? You had everyone working together. Everyone was just, there wasn't really much infrastructure there. And I wasn't there at the very beginning. I was there towards like a year or two before he sold. And it was just chaos, but everyone managed to figure their way through. The way he set up that business was a little bit chaotic in itself, but it was great because it was focusing everyone's mind on getting this one thing done. And I think a lot of the larger companies do some of this as well, right? So everyone's mind was focused to get into Malaysia, right? Whatever it takes. Bosses wants it done, go and get it done. And it happened. Problem occurs when you start getting into a larger, when you start becoming a larger organization. That mindset is great when you're small, but terrible when you're big. Because ultimately, the problem that you got is you forget that you've got 7 million customers that you need to service on a day-to-day basis. And yes, you're going to chase another 4 or 5 million. But the problem is you can't suddenly take all your heads and focus them on something completely different, because they're just going to be spending 100% time focused on that and not keeping the day-to-day running business operationally fit. And so what you found was that people kind of didn't understand priorities and were very stressed, you know, and stressed people make mistakes. And that's when you start, things start not necessarily falling apart, but it just gets more friction and everyone starts shouting at each other because things aren't moving forward. Whereas I think he could have taken a similar approach and said, okay, I'm going to lay the groundwork, but then we're going to do a bit more of a phased approach rather than just telling everyone to go, hey, let's go and do this. So that was chaotic, but fun analogy. It worked, but I wouldn't definitely not recommend that. Then, as you say, there are markets where people do end up selling to because someone picks up the phone and says, yeah, I want an order of X to the US. And you're not going to say no because it's an order, right? But the problem that you get there, and I've seen many horror stories there, is that people go in because someone's called you and said they want your product. You just automatically give them the product. And I've heard a few stories where people aren't getting paid, where, you know, they don't really understand the market. So they don't understand the import costs. They don't understand the full, the length of time it takes to get into that market.
This is certainly something that is hitting lots of businesses right now. After Brexit,
yeah,
which is import taxes and the tariffs are now charged, and people I know that are in the UK buying from the European Union, and within the European Union, like buying from the UK, paying a price, and then the courier turning up and saying you can't have it without paying a whole load more money.
Yeah, exactly, and that's the thing that people don't forget. So I'll give you the good example of Norway, when we were looking to set up obviously the e-commerce business in Denmark that was going to take over for the rest of Scandinavian Germany, and we were setting up the office in Copenhagen. Now, we took a deliberate decision to set up the warehousing in Germany. Now, intuitively, you'd think, well, if I'm selling to the Danish and Swedish market, why not set up a warehouse in Copenhagen, because you can get a bridge to Malmo and go straight across there and you're there. But, you know, if you take a mixed approach and you say, I want to go into this market, let's get an office and set something up, and then work it out from there. Once you're on the ground, you see the realities of the situation. Now, it increased our red tape, because one of the things that people, I don't think, ever really got about the EU is that it's not one, it may be a common market, but it's not really common rules and regulations, right? So the recycling laws in Germany were very different from the recycling laws in Denmark. And the costs of warehousing and the cost of logistics and import, those VAT differentials and all these things that occurred that you had to kind of work around in the EU. And so after doing all of that work, we realized that Germany was the most tax efficient and compliance efficient place to be.
But after doing all that work, so actually this really was that model of a considered plan. Of course, you know, how deeply you do delve into every single aspect. Well, that's a moot point, but the move in that business was a well-considered, well-planned, strategic move to grow the business. Whereas your man in Thailand, well, I suppose arguably his was strategic.
It was,
as an entrepreneur, he only had a vote of one, and his own vote. And when he decided he was doing it, that was that.
Yeah, and I think, so there are some similarities between both approaches, and I think it's a little bit more nuanced than you mentioned. I think the key thing that I think is what we did right in Thailand, what we did right in the Norwegian business was that we put boots on the ground, right? If you're serious about actually going out into a territory, you need to spend time in that territory, because you can't just do things off up. Of course, you think you can because of the drop shipment, et cetera, if you're doing e-commerce business. But really, if you want to build a proper organization and proper business, you need to understand that culture and be in there, right? Do deals with people on the ground. And I'm not saying, obviously, COVID makes that more difficult, but you need to get a local partner in some form, right? Whether that's a logistics partner, whether that's a supply partner, whatever it is, there so you can understand how people operate. And I think with one aspect, in both aspects, in both companies, there was boots on the ground and then there was a plan formulated. I think the way that that plan was communicated back was different. So in Thailand, that was just, you go do this now. And in Norway, it was a little bit more considered and saying, okay, fine, we got these problems, let's figure them out together, rather than everyone running around like crazy people. Where, and you juxtapose that with the approach that we had at Aztec, where it was, right, let's go out there, but let's centralize everything from Dublin, which didn't really make sense. So if you're trying to do business in Argentina and you're sitting in Dublin, it's not going to work. And I think that's one of the issues that we faced there, is because, again, we weren't in the local, we didn't have a local presence that was there full time. We had people flying in and out, but you know, you're easily forgotten. You go to Argentina, have a meeting with someone, they're not going to remember you after 6 months, right? And that's the problem that you've got. Whereas you look at what we're doing with Atom, it's a little bit different in that, obviously, having been out there and had lived out there and having some connections, the first step I took was using the network. So obviously, I picked up the phone. I said, right, okay, we're going to go to the US. Who do I know in the US? Let me pick up three or four key people that I know that are connected into the networks that I need to approach. And initially from that, I got, you know, 10, 15 introductions. And then those 10, 15 introductions were warm leads that I could go in and from there start building through. And in 5 months, you know, we've managed to talk to a lot of people, and you're using one conversation or one partnership to leverage another partnership. So you're building it slowly. And okay, we're going to see that we're seeing through the trickle effects now from the work that we did in February, but it's May, you know, and that's a much shorter time space to deliver.
Well, at what point does one have customers in a market compared to when one enters or embraces a new market? Because as long as me, in this connected world we live in now, it's increasingly easy for random people, for bluebirds, to pop up and buy one's products and services. Is there a difference between that and actually going out to commit to a market and make an insertion?
Yes, because I think anyone can sell any service or product anywhere, right? I mean, you can buy haggis in Canada. So, I mean, you can
buy haggis anywhere, because you can buy it off somebody in Scotland. And with the connected world we live in, we can deliver it anywhere in the world.
Yeah. And funnily enough, I was actually met one of the famous haggis exporters. I forgot the brands when I was up there, but he was talking about how they had to change recipes and they had to, all this kind of stuff that's there. But again, but that's it, right? So you know that you're entering a market when you're changing your recipe, right? If you're just selling what you've got from here, when you've got what you've, when you're doing on your day to day and you're just selling out there, you're just selling earrings, whatever it is, right? But when you're actually catering to that market, you're changing and tailoring your product, you're changing and tailoring your message, and you're trying to understand what is different in that market to your market.
But really, it's about commitment. It's about the level of misfortuneness. How much you're willing to actually commit to do special stuff for that market, be it having an office, having a sales channel, or actually literally changing the recipe.
Definitely. And I think a great example was one of these e-commerce stores where we were selling, for want of a better word, tat on auction, right? And what you found is that, yes, you can sell all sorts of craziness like fluorescent shower heads and things like that in Asia, because it's still quite a novelty. But those customers in Germany weren't buying that kind of stuff, right? They were buying something different. So unless you're tailoring your product base to them, you're not going to attract those customers. So that means you have to make a conscious effort to buy different types of products. You have to have a conscious effort to, in many ways, present those products slightly differently. I mean, Germany is a great example of, if you've got online e-commerce, your German has to be perfect. Germans don't like it if they're buying from this website that has poor German grammar.
So, you mentioned about having boots on the ground. What's your experience in managing people in remote markets and international markets, where maybe they are they best being people that have been brought up in the culture of the business at head office and then go out colonizing, or does it work better where you have locals and then try and imbue some of the culture? And then this comes down also into that area of management control. Do we really know what's going on in Argentina right now? Because we're a long way from Argentina.
So what we've doing at Atom is to say, okay, we've got teams across the world. What we're doing is taking them and building the Atom method, or trying to, not one of a better term, brainwashing, but trying to get them to think in the Atom methodology. We're trying to shift their mindset into a way that is the way that we work, because we know that the way we work works, but obviously adapting it to specific cultures if we need to. So again, over the years, we've had two different types of approach in different businesses. So one approach, again, Aztec, was take everything from central command and then go out there and conquer. And then other approaches have been where you've been there locally, talking to people locally, hiring people locally, and because they understand the market better. And then actually what we're doing is instilling the values that we have into those people. So I know it sounds a bit weird, but oftentimes, let's say, for example, Atom in India, oftentimes when you're dealing with developers in India, you may get developers who just say yes to everything, right? Because they don't want to say they don't know, or they don't want to say that they can't deliver. Whereas what we're trying to do is change that within the culture for our team members only, to say, look, that's not going to fly with us. So you can either adapt to that or just go work somewhere else, because that's not how we work. So if you want to work in a different way, then that's the way that we work, and we're happy with it. If you don't, then fine. There's plenty of other jobs that you can find. And I think for us, it's always worked better when you spend someone from central office has to spend a little bit of time there in order to get that cultural or that mindset fit in there. They don't have to spend months, but even when I was dealing with new development teams in different countries, either myself or one of the senior guys would go out there and work with them for a couple of weeks. And maybe it would be a couple of weeks every 3 months. So you had a constant flow of people coming in, so that they didn't just feel isolated. And I think that's the key. So you have to use local knowledge, but sprinkle your special sauce on top.
And that, okay, right. So where does that thing, where does that sit with that? I can't remember who said it. Think global at local, is that what it's about, having a cross-central approach but letting the local markets behave in an appropriate fashion for that area?
Yeah, that's the old HSBC thing that you see always on the in the airports. I don't really know what they mean by the thinking global piece, right? Because ultimately every country is thinking locally, right? Every market you're in, if you're a German buying shampoo in Germany, you're not thinking about someone in Lithuania buying shampoo, right? That's not really what you're thinking about. So
no, but you maybe not the local part of it, but it is about having a core strategic vision for the business and a big idea that is at the heart of everything we do, but executing it I'm reticent to use this word, a culturally appropriate fashion.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so I think if you're thinking globally, what you're trying to say, what your people are saying is essentially you want to be of a global mindset and be able to
have one big driving purpose.
Yeah, but that doesn't
Other
have to
than actually effectively, you know, I'm aware of this, you know, in one of the businesses I work with, we are actually franchised out, or actually franchised and licensed and brand in various markets around the world. And 5 years down the line, they were unrecognizable from each other because they all just did their own thing. So actually, there was nothing consistent between the UK and South Africa. They were, the only thing they had in common was a similar logo and a similar core function. That was it.
So, and that goes back to my point of, are you really global then? Do you know what I mean? If you have you are global in your physical presence, obviously, and you're global in your, in the way the money's coming from, right? But your mindset hasn't gone out globally, because you have to think locally. And so it depends on whether your special sauce allows for it to be adapted in those local markets. And I think, you know, take Asia, for example, right? There are ways of doing business in China that are very different from ways of doing business in Singapore and Vietnam. So when you're thinking global, are you really thinking globally, or are you thinking of markets that align with your product, your values, your offerings? Do you see what I mean? Well, it doesn't have to be everywhere in the world.
I think that's a really interesting point. How many global businesses really are there? How many businesses that truly are in every part of the world? If we think of the European Union, if we think of North America, if we think of Russia and its cohort, if we think of China, wow, how many businesses are really big in all of those places? Really not that many. So actually, when we talk about international business, and certainly at an early stage, and a small and medium-sized enterprises, is it a case of identifying a number of attractive international markets and bringing them together, rather than saying, yeah, we're going to go global with this?
I think that's it, right? You've got to find the fit. And it can't just be blindly trying to go into every single place that you can imagine, because there are some countries out there just aren't worth it for you, right?
Well, who can? I don't even know how many countries there are in the world, 250 or something like that. What business can genuinely be in 250 different countries? Perhaps Coca-Cola?
Yeah. Maybe. That's pretty much the only one, but only until recently. Yeah, I mean, only until recently Coca-Cola was banned from India, right?
Things right, like I didn't know 15, that.
20 years, right? So they weren't able to operate there. So it was, yeah, it is. It's hard. I think for the people listening, just for to kind of in a, because I know we're running out of time. I think for the people listening, it really is understanding. Is there a demand for what you're doing out there, and can you sell it? And if you want to be in that territory, you need to then be able to, not necessarily live and breathe it, but you have to understand the nuances and the differences between what you're selling in the UK market and, let's say, what you're selling in Australia.
So, yeah, absolutely. And just to sum it up then, the notes that I've taken, or the points I've taken from you today, was the interesting difference between entrepreneurially led businesses, when somebody just makes their mind up and goes and makes it happen, and then the larger organizations that are almost forced to do a more planned approach to make sure the whole ship moves together. And then I guess that also leads into making sure that being opportunistic is never lost, because if something pops up and it's there to be grabbed, one would be daft not to grab the opportunities as they arise, but really making sure that that fits with a real core strategic focus for the business. Because so many businesses, like you mentioned some there, and some that I've been involved with the benefit of hindsight, said, why did we ever do that? We should have recognized that that was going to end up being more trouble than we could deal with. I'm also interested in your point of boots on the ground. I think that's really important as well. And it doesn't mean sending the management team out there, the colonialists, to go and try and tell the locals just do it our way. But I can completely see the value in bringing the culture of the business and introducing that to a team on the ground, and then finding the core elements of your culture that fit, but delivering that in a locally appropriate manner. And I guess the other bit behind all of that is company culture. Is yours really a business that is ready to embrace the challenges of working in multiple markets?
Definitely. And there's a whole other podcast on that, I think.
Well, it's funny that we seem to have a never-ending supply of subject matter for podcasts. So on that, I think we'll just wrap up for today. I hope that has been useful, and we look forward to seeing you next time.
Many thanks for taking the time to listen to the podcast today. If you like what you hear, please leave a review or subscribe. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, all the main podcasting sites. And if you'd like to learn more from us, you can contact Alan. He's alan@tbgp.co.uk. And you can find me at info@atomcto.com.